Hi, I'm Wendy.
And I'm Gwen.
Welcome to Farmworker Chronicles. We are thrilled to bring you today's interview with Monica Ramirez, founder and executive director of Justice for Migrant Women. We recorded this interview back in July of 2024, and it's a two-parter, y'all.
There was just too much great content to cut this interview short, so we decided to split this up and make it two episodes.
So in today's episode, we asked Monica to share her personal journey that led her to create an organization that advocates for the rights of migrant women.
We want to let our listeners know that in this two-parter, we do discuss sexual violence in the context of Justice for Migrant Women's advocacy, but we don't get into a certain case or description of sexual violence.
We met Monica in beautiful Fremont, Ohio, and so we started our conversation by asking her to introduce herself.
Well, hi, it's really great to be here with you. I'm Monica Ramirez. I'm the founder and president of Justice for Migrant Women.
What is Justice for Migrant Women?
So Justice for Migrant Women is an organization that is focused on eradicating sexual violence against migrant women workers. And specifically, our organization's mission is to ensure that migrant women can live and work with dignity and free of sexual violence. The organization was actually founded way back in 2003, the first iteration. I was an Equal Justice Works Fellow and got to create this initiative. And it started as a state-based project in Florida in 2003, and then it was scaled to become a project at Southern Poverty Law Center. And then finally in 2014, Justice for Migrant Women spun off to become its own standalone organization. And we serve migrant women across the United States who work in agriculture as well as other fields. And our work is now becoming more international as well.
That's awesome. What was the impetus for starting Justice for Migrant Women?
Well, you know, I come from the migrant farm worker community and, you know, we're fortunate to be based in the great state of Ohio. This is where my family settled out of the migrant stream. They used to travel from Texas to Ohio and Mississippi to Ohio. So for me, starting Justice was very personal. One, because I come from the community, but also because I started really young as an activist working in the community. And one of the biggest gaps was service to women and addressing some of the issues that migrant women face, including sexual violence. And then the other thing, unfortunately, a lot of people in the migrant farm worker community, particularly women and children, experience sexual violence. And sexual violence is an issue that's personal to me and to my family. And so when I had the chance to create an organization or when I had the chance to develop an idea, it made a lot of sense to me to put the issues of gender equity, specifically gender equity as it pertains to migrant women and sexual violence together with a specific focus on farm worker women and other migrant women. And so that was how the project was born.
You said that you started advocating when you were really young. So what was your first act of advocacy that you did?
Yeah, so I was 14 when I started, like in a formal way, I guess. I didn't even know that was advocacy or activism,
right?
You know, I mean, actually, I never even called myself an activist. People just started calling me an activist about 5 or 6 years ago. But I started raising my voice and taking action on behalf of the farm worker community in a very visible way when I was 14, because here in Fremont, Ohio, we have a newspaper called the Fremont News Messenger. And, you know, I read that paper every single day. My brother was a newspaper boy and we'd take the newspaper all around the neighborhood. So that paper was something that was like central to my household. And in June that summer, I was reading the newspaper and there was this entire pullout section dedicated to the fishermen who visit Fremont. And I didn't understand why there wasn't one dedicated to the farm worker community in the same way. And so I asked my dad about it and my dad told me I should go and ask. And, you know, Fremont, for those of you who might not be familiar, is a very small place. And the newspaper was literally down the street from where I lived. So I rode my bike to the newspaper down the street. And then I went to ask why they didn't have a welcome back farm worker section. And the editor of the paper was actually a man named Roy Wilhelm, and his kids were in my school. So it was very natural, very easy for me to talk to him and ask him you know, why wasn't there a section for farm workers? And thankfully, he didn't kick me out. He could have totally just said, go home on your bike that's outside the door. But he didn't. He actually was really, I think, surprised and perhaps a little bit embarrassed because it hadn't occurred to them to write a section of the newspaper for the farm worker community. So at 14, I got my newspaper beat. And I started writing for the Fremont News Messenger, and I covered farmworker issues. I covered the Latino community. I created a bilingual page in the newspaper, which it was like unheard of at the time. And I actually did that until I was about 21. I wrote for the newspaper. And by the time I was 16, I got a column that was called The Voice of the People. And I always laugh about that because I was like, at 16, I should not have been the voice of the people. But I was. And it was amazing.
That's incredible. I hope you have those articles.
Some of them.
Somewhere clipped and saved.
Yeah, some of them. That was actually one of the best parts, was that people were following along. And so when I would go to church or when I go to school, or at a certain point, I was waitressing at a local Mexican restaurant, and people would bring me the clippings, and they'd say, oh, I read your article, I read your column. And so that was actually really fascinating to me, and perhaps one of the earliest lessons in organizing, because in a way, through those articles, I was organizing and people were following along and they were figuring out what their opinion was, you know, compared to what I'd written, were we in alignment or not? And so, yeah, I have some of those articles in scrapbooks in my mom's house.
Oh,
that is awesome. I don't know if at 14, like, I'm trying to think back at what I was doing. It was definitely not like
writing for
a newspaper. So that's amazing. So in your, you know, we're in Fremont, Ohio, and so clearly this is like your neck of the woods. So I'm just curious, what made you come back and make this your headquarters?
Yeah, well, so I was gone for about 20 years. You know, I went to law school at the Ohio State University, Moritz College of Law, but I left after I graduated from law school and did my work in Florida and in Alabama and other places. And Justice for Margaret Women was actually started when I was in Boston. That was 2014. And then eventually took it to DC and led it there for about 6 years. And I didn't have any plans to come back to Ohio, actually. But then the raid happened, the immigration raid that happened in 2018 that impacted so many families, the Corso's raid. I'd actually been in, the day that it happened, I was in San Francisco, and I started getting all these messages from people pinging me on social media and asking me what to do, because people didn't know what to do to respond to that situation. They didn't know if people had rights or could anyone help the children that were left. And so I got engaged in that advocacy from DC. And then actually what ended up happening, and the reason my husband and I moved back, was we had helped set up this drive to get food and other things to the families, to the children specifically. And we were working with some local community members to help distribute that aid to the families. And we learned that one of the quote unquote churches that was supposed to be helping with the distribution was actually stealing from the kids and charging them fees to give them rides and all these things. And so I happened to be home this particular weekend in July when the organizers told me it was happening, because my grandmother had passed away. So it was really just in conversation with them that the kids still had a lot of needs, that people really wanted to help. Because when we launched this drive, I shared the link in the page, the donation page, with a lot of the celebrities that I was in community with. So really quickly, we ended up having a whole storage facility of goods that had been donated because people had sent them in from all over the country. But I told my husband there was no way that I could be doing the work that needed to happen on the ground from DC. It had to be here. So literally within a week, my husband and I packed up what we could fit in our car and we moved home. So we've been here ever since, and I'm really happy. You know, that's when we made the decision to make Fremont the headquarters for justice. And then, of course, with the pandemic, we were online for a little while, but now we actually have a physical headquarters that's large enough for us to house our humanitarian aid. And, you know, we're looking at how we're going to continue to grow in the area.
So in our first season, we talked a bit about the H-2A program, and we interviewed some male farm workers. However, we have yet to interview a female H-2A worker. So we asked Monica if she could share what she's learned from female farm workers and what their experience has been working along a predominantly male workforce.
Well, I mean, I think it's important for people to know, if they don't already, that very few women actually get to come on H-2A visas, because there is an overwhelming preference for male workers because of gender discrimination. There is the assumption that women are better suited to do things like come on visas to be nannies or to do what is considered women's work, which is not necessarily working in the fields. I've only represented very few women who've worked as H-2A workers, and those women have been brought to work in specialty crops. And so it's just important to know that, because when there is a very small percentage of women working in a workforce that then has very high rates of things like sexual violence, that then actually makes them more vulnerable, right? Because they're in shared living spaces. You know, I've represented women who were hired on crews with men, and they're put in motels and hotels. They're assigned to stay in rooms with men they don't know. In Ohio, as you know, we still have the camps where some people still have outside shower facilities and outside bathrooms. And you know, there's a lot of violence that happens in those places. So people just need to understand that the lack of representation of women in some of these industries actually makes them more prone to some of these problems that we're trying to address. And it also kind of lets the employer off the hook when it comes to having safe environments. And in terms of working alongside male workers, especially the H-2A workers and the non-H-2A workers, I mean, I think one of the challenges has been, and we know that this is against the law, but employers, even though they have the responsibility to recruit locally, they aren't. You know, they say that there aren't enough workers, and so they're only bringing people who are guest workers. So one thing is, women are the first to be laid off, and women are the ones who are not being hired for some of these jobs. And so then they don't have the jobs that they used to have. You know, where we live in Ohio, I would say Ohio as a whole, but in particular in Sandusky County where we're located, there were many, many seasonal workers, men and women. In fact, my family used to work as seasonal workers, picking tomatoes and picking cucumbers. And it was very common for groups of women, you know, my aunts and cousins and people, to go out to the fields together with male family members and work alongside these other workers. But now that's less prevalent because people have such a large number of guest workers they're bringing in. You know, I talked to one local farmer, and he literally told me that the reason that they don't even hire local workers was because one time he'd hired workers and then they got away. He literally said they got away because they left the job. And he was like, and these guys that we bring on visas, they can't go anywhere. So like, that is the sentiment, and they can say it out loud and not think there's anything wrong with saying it, which is also hugely problematic. So I think one of the biggest shifts when it comes to women is that there just are, at least where we are, fewer women, certainly not coming on. There are very few women coming on guest worker visas. I think we've only encountered maybe two or three camps in our outreach where there are women who have actual guest worker visas working. And then in the other places, it's usually seasonal workers who they're not living in the camps. They're living in town and they go to work a few days, or you know, or they work in a different kind of area than the guest workers. There just isn't a lot of connection. And the other thing I think is sad is that when there is connection, there ends up being this kind of weird dynamic, because the local workers who should be getting the same pay and should have the same treatment as people who are coming on guest worker visas, because that's what the law requires, there's a certain kind of resentment towards the guest workers because their conditions aren't as good. The local workers' conditions are not as good. And certainly those people could have viable claims if they're being discriminated against local versus guest workers. But people aren't going to come forward because they just want to have the job that they have. They don't want to lose it. They don't want to get retaliated against. It's a farmer they've known for years and years. Their grandma worked for the same farmer. And so people don't complain. But what it causes then is it starts to create a toxic work environment, and it really pits the local workers against the guest workers. And, you know, that creates a different kind of isolation for the guest workers, who are already isolated because the people who are should be similarly situated to them, the local workers, resent them because they think they're getting a better deal. So I think there's just a lot of problems with the way that the situation has been constructed. I think it's very favorable to the employer. I think it behooves the employer for there to be separation between local seasonal workers and guest workers, because then the local seasonal workers can't share information with the guest workers about their rights or what to do if they're being abused. So there's a lot of ways in which this is very advantageous to the employer, and unfortunately creates a lot of barriers for the workforce. And as we see more and more guest workers coming, we're going to see fewer women. And the few women who are going to be in those positions are unfortunately going to be at risk for a lot of harm.
We've seen a decrease in the number of families that migrate to Ohio to harvest crops and continue to see an increase in guest workers. Occasionally, we will meet female guest workers. However, they are often working as cooks or in packing houses and earning less than their male counterparts. They often are aware that they are earning much less, but because of fear of losing their job, they don't do anything about this. So, Monica, can you talk about how Justice for Migrant Women engages female farm workers in order to empower them?
So, you know, our team has actually, you know, been doing more house meetings, like small group meetings. I think there's a lot of value to doing the deep organizing with the farm worker community. I think sometimes people feel like because they're migratory, because they're living in this temporary housing, that it's sort of like a one visit and you move on and there isn't a chance to do deep organizing. I don't agree with that. And you know, Elizabeth, who's one of our incredible organizers, and she's magical. She just has this magical way about her. So she's able to gain trust pretty easily with people, and they've been doing these house meetings. And it doesn't start with the issues. It starts with, like, how's your family? You know, how are you feeling? What do you need? Like, who are you as a person? It's about your life. And so it might be two or three meetings, right? Like a comida, you have some pan dulce, you have some coffee, whatever. Eventually you get there, right? But it isn't where they necessarily start. So I've had a lot of fun because unfortunately I've not been able to go out on outreach yet this summer. And I've had a lot of fun seeing some of their pictures from these house meetings. And it's only like, you know, five or six women who are gathered together in a kitchen. And, you know, it's amazing. And I love it. So that's part of it. It's like, you don't start there. You don't start with what would be the scariest to them. Because even if we need to tell people what their rights are, or what to do if they're having problems, starting there could make them distrust you because they think that you're either trying to set them up or you're going to get them in trouble, or it might make them feel like they shouldn't be talking to you. So I feel like that's part of it, is like this other relationship building. But I've also served migrant women who are guest workers as a transnational legal advocate. And, you know, I'm really conflicted when it comes to these guest worker programs, because people who are coming on them, they really, really want to be able to come on those visas. They don't want them to be dismantled, even for all the problems they have, because it is better than where they are coming from often. And that's been my experience with migrant women who are coming on the H-2A visas. They still want the chance to come because they understand that at least whatever money they earn, even if it's less than they should be making, it's better than what they could be earning. And so in that situation, we still do let people know what their rights are. But I think that it becomes even more important to create what I call the loop of care, meaning we need to let people know what their rights are and know that they can do something about it if they are being taken advantage of. But they don't have to do it right now. They can finish out their season and they can go back to their country. You know, often the guest workers that we've encountered are from Mexico. And so we want them to know that there is something that could be done if they decide to. Of course, we have to tell them about the statute of limitations and how much time they would have to be able to file a complaint. But we aren't pushing them to try to do something now. If they decide that they want to finish out their contract and then go back, it's important for us to stay in contact with them so that we can then help them when they're back home. I think the before people come, it's also really important to be working with organizations that are helping to prepare guest workers before they come to the U.S. to understand what are their rights, who can help them, who to contact if they need something when they're on the ground. That's what I call the loop of care, that we're really following people on their journey from point of recruitment on migration and then to the US and back home. I think it's just important for us to make sure that we're conveying to people that you don't lose your rights when you cross the border, that there is something that could be done. It's really hard. There's a lot of attorneys that, and even agencies who feel like once people leave the country, it's too difficult to pursue those claims. But in actuality, that's just because it feels like an inconvenience to agencies and attorneys, but it's actually not the law. When people leave, they can still pursue their rights. And so I think it's really important. And we try, and I try in my advocacy to make sure people understand they have rights and that when they leave, they could still pursue them if they have a problem. And I think that that maybe helps people feel a little bit more comfortable and perhaps also relieved, because it's really scary to try to do something, to take action when you're living in the housing that your employer has given you. Or you know that you, if you do something today, it might get you kicked out of the camp and they could send you home tomorrow and you still had 2 months left on your contract. So I think that's, it's important that we tell people what the statute of limitations is for that particular issue, and then that there's a number they can call when they go home if they decide that they want to pursue something.
Do we know if there are less women applying for H-2A visas, or is it just less women getting offered those positions?
I don't know that, but I think it would be hard to know that, because the way it happens, it's you know, it starts with recruitment.
Right.
So I don't think it's that people are being denied. I think that what's happening is that, and my understanding from being in conversation with migrant women who are applying for these, is that the gender steering is happening on the front end.
Right.
So when recruitment is happening, they're not being recruited because they're specifically recruiting able-bodied men of this age group, which, you know, in the United States, we can't advertise for jobs like that. But in other places, they do advertise for jobs like that. Need 10 men ages 18 to 25 or whatever. That's actually happening. That's how they're recruiting people. Recruiters who are recruiting for various positions, they're steering women to take jobs as nannies and to take jobs in other kinds of industries and not in agriculture. So I think yes, probably fewer women are applying, but it's because they've been steered to apply for other kinds of jobs.
Right. I wonder if you know, your narrative work and getting into the hearts of people and hearts of employers might then inform the recruiters.
Maybe. I mean, I think the other thing that's really scary is that some of these recruiters know that women really need these jobs and really want them. And so one of the other real challenges is that we know that sometimes women are being lured to apply for the positions, and that's when sexual violence is happening. And unfortunately, it's not covered. They have no remedy under our law because there is not what they call an extraterritorial application of the law to their country of origin. The law doesn't apply until they've been hired. So it's really scary to think about these recruiters knowing how much these women want these jobs and then kind of setting up a situation in which people think they're going to have a chance to apply. And then they're coming to these meetings, and then they're experiencing sexual violence and they have no remedy.
Right.
That's really scary to me. And I think that part of the narrative work that we have to do, and some of what we're looking at cross-border, because we are now looking at doing more work cross-border as an organization, is we've got to put the networks in place and have the right relationships in place to tell people about the risks that are involved in recruitment and how to determine what's a truthful ad and a not, you know, an ad that's a false ad, or what do you do if you've experienced sexual violence in recruitment? Where do you go? Like, there's so much education that has to happen on those kinds of issues. And there certainly would be a benefit to figuring out, like, how do we communicate out to people, one, that they should be able to apply for any job. They don't have to apply for certain jobs because of their gender. And two, that in recruitment, if something bad happens to them, where do they go in their own country to be able to get help?
Yeah. Thanks for joining us on this episode of Farmworker Chronicles. As we mentioned at the top of the episode, this interview was just too good to slim down to one episode. So we hope you join us next time for the second half.
Thank you to Monica Ramirez for being our guest.
We are your hosts and producers, Wendy and Gwen.
Our executive producer is Chris Pfeiffer.
And if you want to join the conversation, go to wgte.org/FWC. Until then, I'm Gwen.
And I'm Wendy, reminding you to thank a farm worker.
Adios.